Hi, everybody. It's Armand DeMille with you. With The Positive Mind with Roberta Achi today. Bringing you ideas, concepts, thoughts, help you lead a more positively minded life. And today, oh, this is so exciting. Here we go, a little further into this. Recent research that we've uncovered on what's called the refugee syndrome. Refugee, I mean, this is really interesting, and it's so many of you are in this place. The refugee syndrome. So Roberta and I have been working on this for a while now, and we are, and we're just starting to get back to what the refugee syndrome is, and we've come up with some solutions. Let's start off with what is the refugee syndrome, because it affects all of us, or most of us, especially people who live in apartments in Manhattan or are separated from their families. Roberta, welcome back to WBAI. Hi there.
Hi, Armand. It's nice to be back.
What is the refugee syndrome?
Well, it is a physiological response whereby when an organism is separated from its family, group, school, or its environment, a dynamic is set off, triggered, for the survival of that organism.
So any time a being, we call it the refugee syndrome because it's that's what refugees go through, right? When they are separated, when you are mislocated, separated from your original tribe or your environment, something happens, a dynamic happens that takes place in the DNA structure of the brain.
It's an emergency system, Armand, meaning that the brain only sets it off when it perceives that it's absolutely needed, because it costs a lot to the organism, but it can spell survival when that organism is cut off from its roots, his or her roots in the case of a human being, but this applies to other forms of life as well.
Imagine that you had a tire on a truck, and you have a tire on the truck, and built into the tire is some foam. So if you should blow the tire, what happens is the tire fills itself with this foam to make sure it doesn't deflate. Now, as we know, that could be destructive to the tire itself because you'll never be able to use it again once you get to your truck stop. Number one. Number two, it's probably going to kill the axle and the wheels and everything else because they'll be off balance. But it saves the truck.
It saves your life, too.
Yeah. So what this is, what the refugee syndrome is, it's like some way you blow a tire. And the body says, how are we going to get through this?
And you know, Armand, since we've already done a couple of shows on this, I have to say that some people question the name of this, the refugee syndrome, because it sounds so oppressive and dreary, and we don't want to identify with the refugee unless we absolutely have to. But refugee is someone who is, I don't know, from Minnesota and came to New York City to study and then ended up staying here. So it's anybody who's been displaced, who has been cut off from its roots. So it applies not just to political refugees, but to any of us who have been cut off from what is familiar.
What we've noticed is that the response occurs in people who feel separated, alone, often go through this. The symptom, refugeeism, is what we're calling it, is primarily, you know, has a physiological response. So now we're going to talk about it. And again, like Roberta says, this is not just people who are refugees, but the truth of it is, well, no, you know, Roberta, you do a lot of consultations with people. And I do a lot of consultations with people. Now, people come in to see me. Sometimes they're very successful business people. But I've begun perceiving them as refugees. You know, and so when somebody walks into my office, who comes to me for psychological health, for their emotional well-being, I look at them very often and I see a lost child who's cut off from its family and cut off from its environment, who's coming in trying to find something that's missing inside of them. So I see emotionally, I see people as refugees. It's kind of interesting. And I know this has such a strong physiological tie that when you see people for physiological consultations as well, that you must see this also. I mean, do you ever see the people who go through your door as people who are like...
Well, yes, I would say that maybe almost 100% in some way have some aspect of this syndrome, because, like I said, most of us have been cut off from our roots. Most of us are here from elsewhere. I mean, do you find a New Yorker, maybe only you, Armand, you're the only one left, who is actually from New York.
Born in Manhattan.
Born
right?
in Manhattan, raised in Manhattan, who are, you know, you have your roots here. But most people I see are, well, and it doesn't even really matter what they are, but it's how they feel.
Most people are rootless.
Most people are rootless, yes.
Hey, listen, let's go to what these, so people can understand. When we talk about the refugee syndrome, we have two previous programs that we've talked about this in length, but let's just go over it quickly. There are symptoms of the refugee syndrome, which are primarily, the first one is water retention. Now, that kind sounds kind of silly, but it's water retention because the body believes, the survival mechanism believes, the first thing that's going to go is we've got to be able to find water.
And it does not matter, Armand, that we intellectually know that we can find water anywhere. That's not the point. The point is that the brain perceives a separation from one's familiar roots as a potential threat to one's survival. So it changes the kidney function in such a way that the kidneys start to promote water retention. And this happens even if we're surrounded with all kinds of water. It doesn't matter.
A woman came to see me recently. She sold her home. She had a home in Long Island. She sold her home. Took an apartment in Manhattan with her husband, right? Children were out of the house. Suddenly she blows up like a balloon. She says, I don't get it. I'm not eating, and I'm just gaining more and more weight.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And what people said was, to her psychological interpretation, you've been separated from your nurturance, and this is you trying to nurture yourself by eating. But the truth of it was, actually, her body shifted. Her kidneys went kabooey. They said, hold on, we're not going to let you let go of this water. It stored water, it stored food, it stored fat, it started storing things because it believed it was in danger.
Visualize a baby dolphin that somehow gets separated from its mother and its group and gets stranded on a beach somewhere and starts to make sounds to call its mother, and the mother, for some reason, the tide is down, whatever, cannot reach that baby for half a day. If the baby has a way of retaining the water in its body long enough that the tide comes back up and the mother has access to it, great, then the baby survives. If that mechanism didn't kick in, that baby might die. So it's a very simple thing that most organisms developed, and it worked for millions of years. Today, well, it may have become a hindrance, even though when you look at why we have it, it makes a lot of sense.
We're talking about a thing called the refugee syndrome, which Roberta and I, and a number of scientists around the world, are currently working at unearthing. You and I think, are the only two here in America that are working on this right now.
That I know of.
Yeah, the signs of it, the signs of refugee syndrome, weight gain, depression, dramatic hormonal shifts, especially for women, they're very obvious. Things really change. Your period will change. Your breasts will change. Your obvious symptoms will, hair will grow in funny places.
Armand, you can have a variety of symptoms, but let's remember this is primarily, it starts from the brain, but then the first organ that is involved is the kidneys. So you'll have anything pertaining to the kidneys. It could be any kind of kidney dysfunction or bladder dysfunction.
Also, since you have water and electrolytes, anything exactly. Neurological.
Exactly. That's
nerves run on the balance of water, the balance that we have, the chemistry in our water.
That's where I was going to go next, because electrical impulses are really tied in with water in the body, so that any time you have a shift in the balance of fluids in the body, you also have a shift and an impairment in the electrical impulses. Now, since the nervous system functions on electricity, well, you can see how water retention can change the functioning of the nervous system very easily. You can also, Armand, have symptoms, dermatological symptoms, skin problems, eczema, any kind of skin eruption, because think of it this way. The skin is what? Is the membrane that contains the water. So what, something has to happen to the skin in order to facilitate water retention. There's less sweating, for instance. How does that happen? Well, the brain sends out an order to close the pores and to cut down on the evaporation through the skin. So now the skin pH, the level of acidity, alkalinity has to change as well, and on and on and on.
Secondary responses as well as the water responses. A feeling of desperation. You know, think of refugees. What's it like to be on the road? You're a refugee, you lost your home, you've suddenly been, you know, you can't go there anymore, it's been taken away, you don't have a family. Lethargy, consternation.
I think it starts with consternation, a feeling of not knowing where one is. Even though one knows, I'm in this airport about to go and see these people. But on some level, there's a sense of disorientation.
When I get upset, I really get consternated. Lethargy, confusion, unexplained aggressive outbursts. You know, again, a sign of displacement. Now, when we talk about this kind of displacement, we think that addressing this syndrome is critically important. We think it needs to be recognized by the medical community and by the psychiatric community. We're doing what we can to get that to happen. Now we're going to take it to the next step of it. As I said, you're at two previous programs on it, which are available to you. You could hear. But we're going to take it to the next step, which is, I think, an important bridge.
Armand, there's one more thing I wanted to mention, phobias.
We're going to get to that.
Okay.
We're going to get to that. You mean phobic kind of nervous responses as part of a symptom. Now we've noticed that one of the things that we could tell about people who have the refugee syndrome, which is most people, right, that
right.
we meet, most people who come in certainly to me for psychological help.
And to me for nutritional
right.
help.
Okay. Because something's out of whack in both places.
Right.
They seem to be, many of them seem to be prone to addictions of different sorts. Now, including in the addictions, including, not all, but including in them are addictions to medications that are over-the-counter medications. But then there's alcoholism, drug addiction, and sex addiction. These very, very interesting things. So here you are dealing with some addictions that, or things that feel like addictions, like food addictions as well. So here you have now this kind of sense of desperation. Now let's explain this for a minute, how it works. Why does it work, or why is it that somebody who is internally a lost child, somebody who feels like they're an orphan, somebody who feels like they're misplaced in the world, as most people out there feel, who feel despair. You have this feeling. Why would that lead you to alcoholism, drug addiction, sex or food addiction? Right? Why? What goes on in the brain? And where we're going to go, my friends, today we're going to talk to you about a different aspect of love that you've never considered. And we're going to talk about love and its prevalence in our lives and why it seems to be so important.
One thing I wanted to mention, Armand, is that often people come through my door asking me, why is it that even if I starve myself, fast completely, I cannot lose weight? And often with this syndrome, weight loss is very difficult, much more difficult than it should be, because there is a retention of fluids which are very heavy. And so the body the body is having a hard time letting go of the fluids, of the water, but it seems to also affect metabolism. Again, because of the changes in the electrical system, because of the changes in the thyroid, in the brain, in all of the vital organs, and then the changes in the impulses that are sent to the intestines, for instance, Armand. So everything can be slowed down when the body is waterlogged.
What we've noticed, these symptoms lead to addictions, and we're going to talk about why addiction, right?
Addictions, yes.
Now, why does a person who is suddenly, and I'm going to talk about love, friends. You're going to learn something about love today and yourself in relationship to love of your love of people and people's love of you. That's going to be fascinating because we've taken this to the next step. Let's talk about addictions first because this is, we're going to learn something here. Think about it. You're a starved being. You feel like somewhere your body is saying, I'm alone, I'm desperate, and your mind is saying to you, well, just get a good job, be out there, be effective, you know, be successful, go to school, get additional degrees, get a higher salary, get a car, get a plane.
How can you be alone in New York City?
How could you feel bad? You talk yourself out of this bad feeling, but you feel more and more isolated. The more and more you compete with others, you know, in your community, the more isolated you become. So now, here you are feeling isolated. Having this, what we call refugee syndrome, and now there goes a bar. Now there's a bar on the corner of your house where if you go to the bar, something happens. You sit at the bar, and there are four or five people sitting around you, and a bartender, and a shot of liquor. Whiskey, pure sugar, right? Whiskey is the purest form of sugar. Alcohol is a pure form of sugar. You take this in and you drink it down. You take two or three of these and a message goes over your body. You melt. You suddenly feel yourself dissolve. Any of you who know what it's like to take two or three drinks, shots of liquor, know that glow we're talking about. Mm. And that glow, when it settles over you, feels like you've just come home. Now, here's what we say. We say there's potential addiction there, because when that glow wears off, you lose home again.
Sure. Also, when you drink like that, alcohol is diuretic, so you let go of a lot of water, and just for that reason alone, you feel better, because if you're waterlogged, especially the brain, you feel confused, you feel disoriented, you feel like you can't remember things, you know, like that stress feeling. Then you have a couple of shots of whiskey and all of a sudden now you go to the bathroom and you urinate and now you feel better. And so, of course, it's after the effect of the alcohol wears off and you go back to that yucky feeling. Well, the body says, hey, it's easy. Let's just go back to that bar and do it all over again.
Let's think about it, friends. We have tobacco, we have cigarettes, we have alcohol, we have drugs, meaning cocaine, heroin, marijuana, and things like that. And we have sex, and we have food. These are the things that will help you adjust your chemistry in such a way that it'll make you feel like you're safe for a moment or two.
They change the chemistry in the body.
They change the chemistry. Well, wait, how does a sex addiction change the chemistry?
Oh, my goodness. It's one of the most powerful in that sense, because when you interact with another person in a flirtatious and sexual way, you are bombarded with chemicals, excitatory chemicals, as well as relaxing ones, that flood your brain with a sensation of belonging, of enthusiasm, of all kinds of good things. So the brain equates that with safety, even though it may be unsafe sex. It may be unsafe. What you're doing, you know, on an intellectual level, they may not be safe, but the brain does not really care about that because the chemicals say otherwise.
A woman was speaking to me the other day about her tendency to like guys who are narcissistic, grand, filled with themselves guys. She used to. She doesn't like them anymore. She said, I used to like these guys who were these huge kind of ridiculous guys.
They were egos.
Right. And she said, but I was very attracted to them. She said, as soon as I would see these kind of guys, I would feel sexually responsive, and I will feel little compared to their bigness. The bigness of their ego made me feel little and made me feel sexual, and I became very attracted to them, and all I could think about was them from that moment on. Now, if you think of this in terms of the refugee syndrome, it's kind of fascinating. What it did was it returned her to a childlike state where she belonged to a family.
Right.
So for that little while, she's lost, and as long as she could obsess about this guy or these guys, she would be in the family. Sexual and love addiction is all about replicating belonging to a family, in very often an artificial way, but it makes that chemistry work in the body.
Also, what it reminded me of, the description, is someone so big and someone so small, well, it's a sense of a parental protection. Yes, so there's safety there as well, because if someone's ego is that big, I can hide behind it, and it makes me feel safe. And, of course, the problem with all these things is that they don't last.
Well, they may last.
Well, usually, sometimes one has the good luck of finding something that can last, but when we go at it from that place of despair and absolute need, well, it's easy to get tricked into, you know, wannabes.
let's stick with the fact before okay. we get to whether it's good or bad.
Oh, I didn't mean to say it's bad. I'm just saying it may not last.
Neither does alcohol. Neither does drugs. Neither do cigarettes. Neither do anything without replenishing them. So this replenishing compulsion is clearly a sign of this kind of lost child syndrome we're calling the refugee syndrome, kind of this lost being.
Armand, now, do you know about people who suffer from, let's say, chronic backache, and then they fall in love, and when they're in love, they don't feel any pain?
It's amazing, isn't it?
Well, that's a good example of
people who have obsessive compulsive disorders fall in love, and they obsess and compulse over the love, and they don't longer have the obsessive compulsive disorder. Mm. It's like the brain is looking, the chemistry is looking for a place to shift. Roberta, if you would you share with me, with us, this concept of yours related to the body being an organ that takes in and depletes? Let's take a few minutes, because I think that so relates to what we're talking about. And this, my friends, is against the brilliance of Roberta. She was considering this, and if you would, try to get, I'm going to help you see if we can get it to the audience, okay?
Thank you, Armand, for giving me that chance, because I love this theory of mine. Well, I believe that basically for anything that lives, the basic issue is, what am I going to take in that is going to allow me to survive, and what am I going to let go of that is not good for me? And if you think about perception and sensory perception or sensory functions and organs, they're all about taking in a sensation and expressing or letting out a communication, something in response.
Imagine if every one of you had a sign on your wall that said, what am I going to take in that nurtures me? What am I going to let go of that will help cleanse me?
Mm-hmm.
Right? Those are two questions you ask yourself in life. Well, according to Roberta, and I agree with you, we are thinking this on an unconscious level all the time in every organ in our body. When our eyes look at the sun or go to daylight, we are considering whether we wear sunglasses or not. What will I take in? What will I not take in? Every time our body wants to get rid of water, for example, or get rid of something, it's in consideration. Do I want to get rid of this?
Mm.
Taking in, getting rid of. Taking in, getting rid of.
Armand, think of the simplest, the most ancient organism. It was basically a tube. And this tube would contract when it would expel something, and it would expand when it would swallow something, right? Every sensory organ, in a way, does that. The eyes do that. Look at the pupils. They dilate, they contract. Even the skin, every form of perception involves an expansion and a contraction of tissues. Now, in the body, the organ that is in charge of absorbing nutrients is the intestine, the small intestines. And it's all about contracting and expanding rhythmically in order to push the food forward and to withhold what needs to be withheld. Well, the eyes do that too. And when you look at the physiology of all this, even though the eyes are as different from the intestines as can be, but when you look at the tissues and when you look at the brain and when you look at how these things have evolved and what they're connected to and what they're innervated by, there's a similarity in the tissues of the eye and the contraction of the pupil and the intestines and the peristaltic movements. So whenever we are sensing something, perceiving something, and responding to it, to the brain, that's a way of eating, because originally we were just a tube and we were just like a one gigantic or one small intestines.
So taking anything in is part of what we do. Letting go is part of what we do. Actual feeling somebody else's attention to us is no real different than taking in food.
Exactly.
Right? And in other words, anything we take in is the same. Whether we
light,
take in
sound,
light, sound,
physical,
love,
sensation,
physical
touch,
sensation, yes, touch,
smell,
bananas. Whatever it is that we take in.
To the body, it's all food.
It's all food. And we consider, many of us consider love to be the food of our lives. And I'll tell you something, what we've discovered is it's not such a false premise. There is something about it that begins to make sense, and we are uncovering slowly why people have such a tremendous love obsession. Where did the words ever come from, all you need is love?
The Beatles.
All you need is the Beatles.
Well, literally the Beatles, because they are much more ancient than we are, so they figured it out before.
I knew you'd do that.
Sorry.
Okay, but where did it ever come from, this idea that, you know, if you think about everything, what do you need? A good house in the country? No, you need love. What do you need? A good car? No, you need love. If you love and are loved, then everything is going to be cool. Well, wait a minute. What if you're a refugee and you're on a road and you have a husband and the two of you are refugees? Is everything going to be okay? No, you may die. The truth is, this illusion that we have about love being the answer to everything is partially illusion and partially accurate. And when we get back from our break, we're going to take a short musical break today. We are going to talk more about love and what love does for you as related to the refugee syndrome. And in this whole concept of taking in and letting go and taking in and letting go. Hey, friends, what are you taking in today? You're taking in these words? What are you letting go of today? It's such a thought. You know, if you take in all the time, but you don't let go, you know, then you wind up blowing up, you know. And if you let go, but you don't take in,
you consume yourself.
That's right. Hey, this is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. Listen, if you like the positive mind, we are now telling you, you must. And if it's any program on WBAI, just not the positive mind, that you appreciate or dislike, either one, I want you to send physical mail, snail mail, to WBAI at 120 Wall Street, New York, 10005. Physical mail. It's an important time, friends. They are reevaluating all the programs. What you like and what you dislike is what they're going to respond to, maybe. Do not put a title on this. Don't address it to anybody in particular, because then the mail will go through the entire system. It'll touch 10 hands.
Don't you have to put the floor? Also?
Tenth floor. That's good. Do put that on.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back with you in just a minute, my friends. Here we go.
This is Lawrence Block, and you're listening to WBAI in New York City. Listener supported and non-commercial.
Very good, Armand. Excellent.
The Indigos, I-N-D-I-G-O-S, Indigo, On the Road. Hey, Armand DeMille here with you with Roberta Atti, Roberta Maria Atti, The Positive Mind. It should be our theme song, you know, theme song for the refugee syndrome. It's really,
it sounds like
it's called On the Road. It kind of really fits, you know.
Yes, it does.
Most of us spend most of our lives on the road in one form or another without even knowing it, thinking that we're settled in somewhere and we're really still on the road. We call this the refugee syndrome, and we've been relating it. We're going to now find a bridge between why there is such a love obsession in this world and the refugee syndrome, which begins to make sense. And we're using as our bridge addictions. Understand addictions. Very interesting what you said about taking in and not taking out. When you take in artificially, Roberta, when you take in, when you are looking to try to feel at home and you wind up with either alcohol, drugs, right, food, sex addiction, love addiction, all of these things, cigarettes, all of these things that are trying to keep you to make you believe that you have some kind of sense of being at home. It's so interesting because cigarettes are kind of an interesting one. You light a cigarette and it just triggers all of your metabolic responses. That nicotine sets you off and it, boom, it sends you running. And here you feel for that minute of lighting that cigarette calm again.
But see, it's not even the nicotine, it's the dopamine that does it. The nicotine triggers a response in the body that increases the outpour of dopamine into places in the brain that are connected to pleasure. Pleasure is what we feel when we are at home and we feel safe and well-fed and there's no fear and there's no threat and we feel, you know, in our center, like my grandma used to say.
Yeah, but then how does orgasm do it? just thought it would suddenly wake a few people up. No, it really, if a cigarette will do it, right? How will sex do it? You know, the sex addiction, the people who are going out there to have sex and they want to get involved in sex. How does sex give you a feeling?
Pretty much in the same way.
So how about a cigarette after sex with a drink in your hands?
Well, that's when someone just is insatiable, where they can't get enough dopamine. And then
they got to have pizza.
Yes. Well, the thing is that, yes, what I've noticed, Armand, is that when these things are obtained in this way, yes, they do fill the spot, but for a short time, so it's never enough. There's always room for more. And these are chemicals, Armand. They're chemicals that the brain, the nervous system, secretes when we feel safe, when we feel at home. And so, for instance, dopamine. Dopamine is a neurotransmitter that allows us to feel focused, clear-minded, attentive, capable of perceiving things in the right way.
Which is the opposite of the refugee syndrome, which makes you feel listless, not having a place to be, not having a place you belong.
Lethargic,
you know? So it's really interesting. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. We're continuing our discussion about the refugee syndrome, and we're taking it to this place about addictions. Even though we've discussed this, we're going to take it to one more place today. So let's just consider if dopamine.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder why they call dope.
Yeah,
you think it's because it does have anything to do with dopamine? Or because it makes you feel dopey?
That's a good question.
Well, you got to be dopey to do it.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So if you're going to have alcoholism, drugs, sex addiction, love addiction.
Don't forget food, because
all
food
of these things.
Food
and food, right?
Big mood alterer.
What has been the most successful cure for all of these things? What has been the most successful cure? What has been the treatment of choice? Do you think it's worked to give some person the equivalent of Ipecac, or to give somebody the equivalent of things that will turn you off, or they give you drugs for your drug addiction? None of that has worked. The only thing that seems to have worked for all of these addictions, including food addiction, sex addiction, love addiction, drug addiction, alcohol addiction, has been one phenomenon that's been around for, 20, 30 years, and has been so totally successful, is
meetings?
Alcoholics Anonymous?
Self-support groups?
Overeaters Anonymous, right? Sexaholics Anonymous? Loveaholics Anonymous? Drug Narcanautics, Narcoludics, Bukadukics,
Boataholics Anonymous.
Boataholics.
You know, yeah, people who are addicted to boats.
Boats?
I've read that there is such a thing.
Okay, and I can see it. And I can see it, because I've seen this. I've actually seen that with people.
Mm-hmm.
So what is it about this that makes it suddenly feel like you could afford to get off your heroin, or get off your cocaine, or get off your marijuana, or get off your alcohol?
And people get confused because they think it's a religious thing, and that, you know, this is a cult or something, and that they have to believe in God in order to participate or to be part of it. And it's not true at all, because agnostics can benefit from the dynamic of self-support groups and never get to the point where they believe in God.
Why are those groups successful? This is the question. If it's not the program, you go into one of these meetings, and very often you'll go into a meeting, and everybody will sit around and read a book.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll read a piece of book, and they'll pass it on, and you read the next chapter, the next few lines, and then you pass it on, and somebody reads the next few lines. What is it, like second grade? We're all going to read a couple of lines?
Yeah.
Why does that work? Why does it work to say these words over and over, to have somebody talk to you? Because if you have the refugee syndrome, which is motivating you to take these drugs or to be in these addictions, the meeting, the actual meeting, replaces the lost community. Your brain, like Roberta says, gets fed. Your brain is taking in the form of words, the physical presence, probably even the odors, you know, probably the olfactory glands taken as well. You're now in the presence of other people who are part of your community, and you redevelop community. Mm-hmm. Psychotherapy, I believe, has as a major part of its effectiveness community. One of the things I've noticed about our psychotherapeutic practice here is because we have so many therapists working here, there are a lot of clients who come through, and a lot of clients who come through have a sense of community. They belong here. They feel like this is their home.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that, you know, they just feel safe. They walk in the door, they sit down, and there's a sense of safety they feel because they're part of something.
And there's something to be said, Armand, about connecting with a group of people without a business agenda, without an intention to use anyone, without thinking about money or is this going to be a profitable investment of my time. This isn't why people go to these meetings. And often, if they go for these reasons, they don't connect. The time when people succeed in getting their needs met through the group is when they go without any other agenda other than to share who they are and to share in who everyone else is just as they are, accepting everyone just as they are without the need to change anyone, without the need to better.
There's no advice, there's no crosstalk, there's no people telling you who you are and what you're saying is wrong. You get a chance to talk, which means you get a chance to put out. As in getting rid of.
To let go. Mm-hmm.
To let go of stuff. You just say your words and the people listen to you, but they don't respond.
They take it in and they let it go.
They take it in and they let it go. See, you open up the channel of your body and mind to taking in and letting go. And taking in and letting go. And if you can take in and let go in a natural flow, you're back home.
Right. And you think of business meetings, people don't take in and let go. People take in and hold on.
Sure.
Right? In these meetings, you listen to someone who is desperate, who is maybe not even articulate enough to express anything, maybe who is so damaged by drugs and alcohol that their speech is slurred and they don't make much sense and they're all over the place, and it does not matter because you're not listening to the words, or it does not matter what they're saying. All that matters is that you're there and they are too.
This sense of community which has been brought about, which exists, we're not promoting it. We're saying we think we see why it works, because it's obvious that it does work. It is the solution for so many people. Why does it work? Why does psychotherapy work? Why do these meetings work? They work because they are giving the person the sense that they belong to something. Now, this is critically important. If these meetings work in such a way, then unconsciously, aren't we all desirous of having that kind of connection with other people? And isn't it therefore, doesn't it make sense that the people with the smallest connection with family have, the ones who have the smallest connection with family are the ones who tend to find themselves mostly focused on finding love. They're finding love. They're out there. We're obsessed with love. We're obsessed with it. We've got to find it. We've got to look for it. Look.
Well, and Armand, in a family, in a good functional family, if there is such a thing left still in existence, what is the best feeling a child can have on a consistent basis? I mean, there are times, of course, when every family will have a fight, whatever, but consistently the child gets the feeling that he or she is loved consistently for who she or he is, and that he's listened to, that he can express himself or herself, that there's a flow, there's an exchange of, well, should we call it love, should we call it energy, should we call it food, should
well,
we call it
Well, you see,
that's
where we run into the problem. What we say is love, and we have this word that really people get stuck on, you know, they get stuck on this word love. If it is, there is such an energy, but the energy is so confused by what people call attachment. Let's say love instinct. Now, let's say if you feel a love instinct, I am saying that the more despair that you feel in your life, the more refugee that you are, the more love instinct you're going to feel. And this means there's a part of you that is crying out to belong to something. And how do you see it? You see it in love. That's why if you're a teenager and you feel yourself separating from your family, you very often get into obsessions about magazine characters and people. And you feel yourself separating on one level and you're obsessing on the other level. You fall in love with the captain of the football team, you know? Mm. You have these things that you think about all day long. And the more you obsess about it, the more you think about it, the more time you spend thinking about your lover, the more you fill yourself with this feeling of home. I know, my friends, I know that when you feel like you found the only home in the arms of one particular person, how addictive that is. You gotta have it.
Yeah. You know, Armand,
there is no way out of it, you know.
Remember, I think it was a while ago we talked about interoception, which is the perception that is already inside me. There's a structure of my nervous system that is going to respond to a trigger that may be coming from the outside, but the pathway of the nerves is already established. So I may respond in a chemical way to a certain situation whereby I feel love internally. The chemistry inside my body is such that I feel this love internally and it makes me feel safe. If I have that kind of response when I drink or when I seek, sex, casual sex, what I'm looking for is really to change my chemistry.
That's right.
Not the other person, not the
drink,
not the
drug. It has nothing to
do
with the other person.
No.
It's like, how do I get myself back to feeling good? I'm going to use this other person, and I'm going to use my obsession with love. You know, I hate to say it, but religion will do the same thing for you.
Well, who was that guy, the opium of the people? Who
Jesus.
Was, no.
No, I'm sorry.
One of the communist people said, I think it was... I forget. Mao, maybe? Mao Zedong said that the religion is the opium of the masses. In a very real sense, when people go to church, Armand, the dynamic that sets in is this sense of belonging.
Worship. The whole idea of worship.
And it's interoception. It's what happens to the chemistry in the brain, in the body, when we feel safe, when we feel loved, when we're not there for business, when we accept others as they are, what happens is the chemistry in the body sets in that creates health. It's health supportive.
You know, if you think about it, it goes so much further than that. Even think about it on a political level. Let's say that you're somebody who supported and loved your country, and your feeling was your connection with your country for the longest time. And then someone comes along and says, hey, you know, maybe you're beating around the bush. Maybe, you know, this is not exactly what it seems to be. Maybe your country is doing things that are not right. What you threaten to do is you throw away your very connection to the country you love. That's why people will not switch, that's why people will be, you know, Nixon is the man, whether or not we've got a Vietnam War. And,
right.
And it's like they cannot abandon their faith, because to abandon their faith is to abandon their connection. They would be lost children.
Yes, it's a chemical need for safety that makes a person fanatically hold on to a belief system that intellectually they're certainly smart enough to see that it does not work. But the chemistry is such that it's compelling the person to hold on to that belief system as if their very life depended on it, and in a sense it does.
The biggest example of refugeeism in this country that was observable was the day Kennedy was shot. The day Kennedy was shot, was assassinated, everybody walked around like they were lost. People walked through the streets as if they were just, somebody had just nuked the entire town.
Mm.
And I remember it very well.
What year was that?
In the 60s,
or something?
Yeah. And people would be walking by, and I remember when we got the call, you know, we shut down business right away, and people wouldn't talk to each other, and everybody was weeping. But it would have been the same if we were seeing people in Kosovo walking down streets after their home was destroyed. The emotional reaction on the inside to be separated from that way, from this benign thing that you thought you were attached to, connected to,
yeah,
was phenomenal.
You know, I had that. I was too young when Kennedy was assassinated, and I was in Italy, so I heard of it, but it didn't hit me like that. But you know, when I remember feeling that way, the day I was here in Manhattan, 9/11.
Sure.
I walked around the streets, and everyone was lost, and everyone was looking around with disorientation, consternation, and not knowing what was real and what was not.
And what people needed. What people needed is what the station provided, what WBAI provided, which is connection.
That's right.
And what people needed was connection to each other, and it took a while for people to find each other again.
Yes.
So that they could feel safe. It took over a year.
Yes.
Because everybody was being told any minute now more danger is going to exist.
And remember, they sealed us off. Nobody could leave the city.
Right.
And for a while we couldn't even call. So we were in this place not knowing if a bomb was going to fall on us. We had no idea what was going on. And everyone felt like a refugee within the city. And I remember the faces, just like what you described, Armand, this look in people's eyes like a baby dolphin stranded on a beach. And by the way, it was Marx who said that religion is the opium of the masses. I need to make that correction because it's important.
Love is a mighty power. It is light. It is the same as light. It is the same as food. It is the energy of life. It brings us into life and sustains us while we live and breathe. Love is an energy, not a substance. It's an essence, not matter. You can't contain it. You can't put it in a box, but you can feel it, taste it, and know it. And its presence is unmistakable. It's exquisite. It's profound. And when you're in love, nobody, not even your best friend or your parents or even your own mind, can talk you out of it, because it's this mysterious, beautiful thing that makes you feel happy, makes you feel hope, allows you to believe that the impossible can happen. It can't be defined or analyzed in many ways, but we see that there is something about the connection. You know, the connection between us and our fellow man is critically important. We lose it for one reason or another. Maybe it's because our family came along and our family is separated from us. Maybe because we're alienated from our friends. Maybe because we believe in independence. Whatever it is, when we have as an antidote to the refugee syndrome, this whole concept of loving and being loved. Now, this is something that you may need to work on in your life. You may need to focus not on finding a mate, but finding that feeling inside you so that you can exist with this feeling inside you, which is there all the time.
You said something very important, Armand, just now when you equated love with light. A while ago, we did a show where we talked about light, and I said, light arrives before it leaves. It's the fastest thing, and it never moves, because it's so fast that it arrives before it leaves. And in a way, you just said the same thing about love, that it's always there. Therefore, it arrives before it leaves. And we don't need to go seek it, because it's there all the time, and it's outside of space and time. It's just there, like light. So this thing you just said reminded me of what we said.
Oh, I wish we had more time. This is Armand DeMille with Roberta Atti. We're talking about the refugee syndrome. There are, if you've heard this for the first time, this is the third in our series of three programs on the refugee syndrome. The other two are available by calling my office at 212, and this one, 212-757-4488. You can get a recording of this, 212-757-4488. And remember, do keep your letters, not email, but actual physical letters flowing to WBAI in response to your likes and dislikes of the many different programs on BAI. And once more, my friends, don't send one letter with 10 mentions. Send one letter for each program, and you'll be making a real contribution. We'll be back with you soon. I'll be back with you tomorrow at 1 o'clock. Roberta, I thank you once again. We've got more to go with this, I know.
Thank you, Armand. Thank you. This is important information to put out there, I feel. And I am very grateful to you for the opportunity.
Hey, back with you tomorrow at 1 p.m., my friends. Bye-bye for now.